Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Jan Willis. I should say Dr. Jan Willis. She is a professor at Wesleyan University in the Department of Religion, the professor of religion, and this year is on sabbatical and living in Holland, but you usually can find her at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. We met at an evening in Oakland, California, which was entitled Racism, Social Justice, and Active Compassion. And that's where we're going to start out talking about. I want to let you know, too, that Jan Willis is a writer and has written many books on Tibetan Buddhism, of which she is a practitioner and a teacher. A couple of them are Enlightened Beings, Life Stories from the Ganden Oral Tradition, and Feminine Ground, Essays on Women in Tibet. She's written a lot of things, most recently an autobiography called Dreaming Me. It was called An African-American Women's Spiritual Journey. The title got changed, which is what Jan talked about in this evening, where she was speaking about racism, social justice, and active compassion. And you referred to it, Jan, as Racism 101, the way the title of that book got changed. Let's just start out talking about your book and yourself. You grew up in the South, in Mississippi, was it?
Alabama. I grew up in a mining camp called Osina, which is just outside the city limits of Birmingham. And my father was a steelworker, so he kept a job when the Osina mine closed. But it was the 50s and 60s. Jim Crow era, very strong, white drinking fountains, colored drinking fountains. And I was at segregated schools, even though I entered school in 1954. That just meant Alabama spent the next 12 years trying to block that federal order. Mm-hmm. So I was bused to keep us apart, and I graduated from a still segregated county school.
I was just so struck with you when I met you and the different kind of vibes you have. I've also been a student of Buddhism for many years and was just struck by your warmth and and liveliness, which is different than a lot of people's stereotype about Buddhism and actually is different than some of my experience, not necessarily with teachers, but with students. And I was reading that that you were taught to roll up your windows because the Ku Klux Klan could get you, and where you grew up was a very strong Ku Klux Klan area, and in fact, something did indeed happen to you. And I was comparing that with my experience being in a Buddhist retreat in East Oakland. Many times we had retreats there, and East Oakland is a place where there are many African Americans and many people of color and many poor people, and we were told to roll up the windows, and that just really pushed my buttons. I thought, you know, like, don't confuse poverty with danger. And so it was really interesting to read that, you know, the different experiences. Mm-hmm. If you want to comment more on that, that would be great, because that's where we started out on the issue of racism. I don't know if you have to comment on that, but the issue of racism in this country, and of course many institutions also reflect that because we are in the United States.
Well, it's a big subject, and the thing is, it's not new to any people of color in this country. And I don't want to exclude other people because people have experienced pain. But certainly there are little things that happen all the time if you're a person of color in this country. And those little things are often invisible to anybody who's not a person of color. But they're, the little indignities that are suffered on a daily basis are difficult to see and yet ever present. And one of the things that struck me about the talk that you attended was that people started articulating and speaking that pain. And to go just one step further into the Buddhist situation here, the next day following that really quite spectacular, quite marvelous, quite emotional evening, was that after people in Oakland, various voices, had voiced their pain, a woman finding out that her daughter had been molested, a young boy remembering his uncle in El Salvador, speaking that pain, and he said, "Hatred fuels my struggle. Somebody told me to come and listen to you. Now what you gonna tell me?" Mm-hmm. It was a very powerful evening. And then it was wonderful when someone else in the audience said to that young man, "I hear the love you had for your uncle. Let's see if that love can power your struggle, fuel your struggle." Well, it was a great evening and one of the most diverse groups I've been in. Mm-hmm. The next morning, a white Buddhist practitioner called me, who said, "That was a wonderful, wonderful evening." And people, the comment was, they, I'm always careful of that word, they really needed to release their pain. Now, maybe they'll get interested in Buddhism. And I thought that was exactly the wrong way to see that. Because the fundamental Buddhist teaching says there is suffering, and we're told that there's an activity that goes along with that, and that activity is to understand suffering. So the comment just brought up in me the clear distinction that there is in terms of understanding, because it was clear to any of us there, to most of us there, that those people, in speaking their pain, were understanding suffering. Not intellectually, not their three types of suffering, dukkha, dukkha, viparinama, dukkha, samskara, dukkha, not intellectually, but what in the way that the Buddha intended. They understood suffering. They were already on the path. Mm-hmm. They were already on the Buddha's path. So I think that sometimes that gets lost. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons it gets lost is that we in the West, Western Buddhist, have a tendency to be so enamored, and I think it's primarily with the cultural traditions of Buddhism that have come here, that we tend to take on the cultural forms in ways that are foreign to us, not our own. And so there comes to be an air of pretense about how we practice. I don't mean that harshly, I mean it in this way. One of the best pieces of advice I ever received was from Kala Rinpoche in 1974, when he said Buddhism is about becoming authentic, authentically ourselves. That's what enlightenment means, becoming authentically ourselves. So, whatever you do, please don't swap one pretense for another. So I think what happens at some Buddhist centers, with some Buddhist practices, some practitioners, is that they take on the practice. It's as though yesterday I wasn't a Buddhist, today I'm a Buddhist, and now I behave this way, or now I act this way. And I think that's a serious loss of time, and it's serious pretense, and it is swapping one pretense for another and missing the whole point of the Buddhist path.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the First Noble Truth is, which is, I guess, about as basic of Buddhism as you can get that cuts across all traditions, is there is suffering, and I certainly understand it to be about ending suffering, and there's that's a huge subject, to say the least. But maybe you'd like to say something more about it, Jan Willis, this huge subject. And I always wonder... that people aren't more interested in being and being activists, doing things to change the world, although I know it's also about looking into yourself. It doesn't seem like it's only about looking into yourself. It's also compassion for others. And I know that you started out, or didn't start out, you're already along the way, but a Black Panther, and now you work in a women's prison in Connecticut. So just talk about that, if you would.
Okay, I'll try. Mm-hmm. Well, I think Buddhism is a path of peace and nonviolence, but I don't think the choice of peace precludes action. Action to bring about social justice. I don't see them as contradictory. If anything, I think the tools that Buddhism offers in terms of meditative techniques can help ground us, can help develop that compassion, can help energize our struggles. But compassion is an active thing, and I think that's how it's seen in Buddhism throughout. That's what the Buddha was doing. He didn't just attain enlightenment and decide to remain blissed out. He decided to teach it. And so I don't see any contradiction, though people seem to sometimes come up with that, that if you're going to be a pacifist, that means you've got to be passive. I think that's absolutely false.
What particularly grabbed you about Buddhism when you first encountered it?
I was fortunate enough to meet Lama Yeshe, Lama Tupten Yeshe in Nepal. And when I met him, I was carrying around an incredible amount of baggage. A lot of anger, a lot of low self-esteem. I'd been told all my life I was less than human growing up in the South. I was told that I couldn't possibly be intelligent. And you internalize that stuff. So when I met Lama Yeshe, here was a person who was very gentle and very loving and very patient with me. Because one of the things that I also carried was a little arrogant air, which was just pretense, because I was so frightened. And he was very patient with that.
And he's Tibetan?
He's Tibetan, yes. Lama Tupten Yeshe, who just turned out to be the most remarkable teacher for me, because he was a person who could see that low self-esteem and who could show me ways to get at the wounds that I suffered, and to start to heal them.
Mm-hmm. Well, say more about that. How? What did you, I mean? I know this is an impossible question to hear. You've been a student of Buddhism and practicing for all these many, many years, and you know it's hard to sum up in a few sentences. But if you can at all, you know what the core of that. And I know you work with people in prison. That's what you're dealing with, right?
Okay. Two things. Lama Yeshe did it with me over 15 years by just encouraging me and telling me I was okay. It took 15 years. One day I heard him.
He's a supportive friend.
He encouraged me. He told me I was intelligent. He gave me a name which meant high intelligence. And he also gave me the name that is Joy of the Dharma. And I was really sad. So I looked forward to the time when that name might be authentically me, you know. But Lama Yeshe encouraged me by, you know, engaging my intellect, by telling me on one occasion, he said, I say one thing and you see five. And because my self-esteem was so injured, it took me about 2 months to be brave enough to say, is that bad? He said, of course not. Of course not, dear. That means you're quick. That means quick intelligence. So it became a habit that as we'd be having various conversations over the years, he would raise his hand and show five fingers. Mm-hmm. Sweet little things like that. And I think the other thing that I want to mention is that not only was Lama Yeshe perfect for me, but Vajrayana teachings were perfect for me. Because the idea in Vajrayana is that you take the end as the means. So you want to become enlightened? Become enlightened now. You want to be Buddha? Visualize yourself as Buddha now. Now, but you have to avoid arrogance, so you need a guide. But the idea is that we visualize ourselves anyway, all the time, usually very negatively. The Vajrayana says now, substitute for those negative imaging you give yourself, positive ones. Everything is based on Buddha nature. We are already Buddhas, just like the Zen tradition is based upon that. So it says, now how are you going to bring that Buddhahood out? Tantra, or Vajrayana Buddhism, says, try on these various deities. Visualize yourself as green Tara. And now, that doesn't mean turn green. That means realize your own innate fearlessness. Green Tara is the goddess of fearlessness. Get in touch with that. Your own courage, your own strength, your own fearlessness. And so even though there are over 700 deities in the Vajrayana pantheon, these deities are representative, iconographically and so forth. They're representative of aspects of the enlightened mind. So don't feel smart. Visualize yourself as Manjushri, Buddha of wisdom. Feel like you could use some compassion work? Visualize yourself as Avalokiteshvara, the Buddha of compassion. And slowly, slowly, what you're doing is you're becoming habituated to seeing and feeling yourself differently and positively. So for me, with such low self-esteem, to meet a teacher who immediately saw that as the root problem and then who offered Vajrayana techniques to counter that problem, he was just perfect, and the teaching was just perfect. And so now in prisons, in prison work, green Tara, you see, is an obvious meditative visualization. And we try our best not to involve Buddhist terminology, but just to get at the core that, you know, you can be fearless. We're talking about women who are incarcerated, you know, and who have a lot of fear and who have a lot of guilt and who have a lot of worries, you know, with kids and families, you know. So we use techniques that we've garnered from Buddhism and from the women's self-help movement in Holland. That's my partner, Marlies Bosch, and I, to try to come up with exercises and visualizations that are very practical that can be used every day in the prisons. And we've had good response from the women who say to us amidst horrific stories that they're still doing such and such practice and it's helping.
Mm-hmm. Jan Willis, do you use Tibetan images in the prison? I mean, you're saying visualize yourself as. Do you need to do that? And I want to remind people who might have just tuned in that you are work as a professor of religion, Dr. Jan Willis at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. That's just a little reminder to people. So back to the question about Tibetan images when you're working with people who are not necessarily students of Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, I think my tact is a little unusual here. When I say I think that most of this process needn't be used. But I'll give you an example. We did take in images of green Tara. This was the only time we did it into the prison. And we gave green Tara cards, you know, those little laminated cards with the mantra on the back. The women love the mantra because it sounded like a drum beat. Om tu tare tu tare tu ture swaha. Om tare tu tare tu re swaha. They loved that. But when we went back the next week, someone said, you know, friend saw this and said, you don't want to be dealing with any deity that's green. You don't want to be dealing with something that's green. That can't be good for you. So then we had to give the talk about, no, it doesn't matter that whether or not you see yourself as this particular Tibetan iconographic form. The idea is to get in touch with the energy inside yourself, which is fearless. And everybody could understand that, and we didn't take any more images in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and actually, in different traditions, certainly in shamanism and a lot of different traditions, idea is to get in touch with our own, I guess empowerment is like a word, or our own, and our own divinity, that we can really do a whole lot more than we think we can do. Actually, I was involved in something where we were transforming water from being poisonous to being totally drinkable.
by love, basically, by really connecting and loving that water. So this stuff really cuts across. But it's not, we're not used to it, that's for sure.
Most human beings shy away from acknowledging that they have real power.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of encouragement not to realize,
exactly.
Discouragement from realizing, that's mm-hmm. for sure. It's challenging. It's definitely challenging. Well, you've just come, Jan Willis, from teaching a African-American Buddhist retreat, which you said was so wonderful. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that retreat and the issue of Buddhism in the United States. Maybe I'll just dive into this. Buddhism in the United States, I sort of started out here, tends to be mostly white people, mostly people who are, they're not necessarily all rich by any means, but these are gross generalizations, obviously, but tends to be people who are white and affluent, which is really interesting when it's a lot about suffering. So I'm actually changing direction as I hear myself talk.
Okay, well, this is a biggie. Let's see if I can jump in anywhere there. Well, I was not teaching the retreat. I was one of 15 teachers, which is an important point to make. At Spirit Rock, for 5 days, there were gathered 90 African-American Buddhist practitioners. It was unlike anything that Spirit Rock had seen.
And Spirit Rock is a Vipassana Buddhist center in Northern California.
Exactly. It's in Woodacre, California, just in Marin County. Normally at this Spirit Rock place, beautiful, beautiful place, 400 acres, gorgeous, Jack Kornfield delivers a lecture, usually 300 people, every Monday night. Of those 300, one or two might be a person of color. So this retreat was really remarkable to have 90 African-American practitioners in one place, Buddhist teachings, which I find helpful and very particularly helpful for people who have suffered from the legacy of slavery, from other kinds of traumatic or painful histories. I've wanted to make these methods accessible. And I don't get a chance at Wesleyan. Every now and then I get 4 or 5 students in a class of 90. And I'm always grateful for that. But at Spirit Rock, we were all gathered and we were all concerned about this one issue. The reason I think Buddhism in America is mostly white and mostly upper middle class is that the way Buddhism has come here, retreats are emphasized, which cost money and which require time. And most people are working class people. Those people you can't just take off for 3 months and go on a retreat. You can't just take off for 2 weeks whenever you want and go on a retreat. So money and leisure time are part of the requirements of being a Buddhist in America. But that doesn't take the voice of Buddhism, that doesn't take the message of Buddhism to people who not only can profit greatly from it, but who already are so far along the path of understanding it and taking it in. And so I want it to become available to them. That's what I see as one of my missions.
Mm-hmm. And if you would comment to it about the usefulness for peace and for creating a different kind of world in general for all people. And you're a Tibetan Buddhist, but there are many traditions. And at that retreat you were talking about, you said that people were from all different traditions. So, there's a lot to choose from.
Exactly. It was rare because there were 90 of us gathered together. It was rare because it was cross-traditional and cross-lineage. We had Vajrayana teachers, African-American teachers. We had Zen African-American teachers. We had Vipassana African-American teachers. It was a marvelous, marvelous gathering. We also had, because they came to see me for interviews, 3 people there, blacks, who had wandered in, who had come on scholarship, who'd made great effort to get there, who said, "What about us?" And they came to me because I call myself a Baptist Buddhist, And they said, what about us? Do we have to, you know, suffer the guilt of leaving the tradition in which we were raised up? And, of course, my sentiment is absolutely not. It is a great virtue to think of being able to love one's neighbor as oneself, but it's very difficult. So we can cherish those Christian virtues that we grew up with, but some of us need tools. Those tools are provided by Buddhism to make it come about. At the end, I'd like to give credit to a student who was one of these students who came to me. She said, I always considered that prayer was asking God for something and that meditation was listening. I thought, perfect. I said, can I quote you on that?
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Jan Willis, thank you so much. And I want to urge people to look for your book, Dreaming Me, From Baptist to Buddhist, One Woman's Spiritual Journey.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.